From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Hillary Clinton is continuing a multi-day fundraising blitz. She's been in California since Monday, where this week she's attending 7 fundraisers in 3 days. This as drama continues regarding her State Department emails and the future of the Clinton Foundation should she win the presidential election. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is on the campaign trail, working to get his numbers back up in the polls after a staffing shakeup last week. Now, we're about to turn the corner into fall, so races of all kind, including congressional races, are ramping up across the country. In this week's District Profile, we look at the race for California's 7th, where there's a whiff of scandal on both sides of the ticket. Joining us now is Bob Moffitt, Sacramento Region reporter at Capital Public Radio. And Bob, let's start with the Democratic incumbent in this race, Ami Bera. Recently, his 83-year-old father was sentenced to prison for election fraud. So tell us about that.
Well, his father apparently thought it would be a good idea to go to friends and family and ask them to donate to his son's congressional campaign with the promise of reimbursing them with the money that they had spent. This is a clear violation of election law, and the U.S. Attorney's Office took him to court and won. So it looks like Ami Bera's father will be serving about 10 months in prison, probably.
So are the sins of the father then redounding on the son?
Well, the son says he didn't have anything to do with it, and the U.S. attorney seems to agree with him, saying that there was no proof that, despite the number of people who were involved in this, that word had apparently never gotten back to Ami Bera's campaign or to the candidate himself. Ami Bera has described his father's actions as regrettable and tragic.
But, of course, that doesn't stop political opponents from trying to make some hay out of this. Scott Jones is the current Sacramento County Sheriff. He's Bera's opponent, but he himself is no stranger to scandal. There's a multi-million-dollar lawsuit going on against the sheriff's department. What's happening there?
Well, that's true, and there's two things there that you brought up. One is that he's making hay out of it, but he's making hay out of it by proposing campaign finance regulations. On the lawsuit side of things, the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department recently lost a $3.5 million settlement brought by some of its female deputies claiming sexual harassment and retribution when complaints were made. Jones is not named specifically in the suit, but his name is involved somewhat in characterizations of people within the department. An officer within the department says that he approached her multiple times, that they had engaged in numerous instances of mutual kissing, and that he had come on to her, for lack of a better term, multiple times. He says none of this was true. There were never complaints filed. She was not allowed to testify during the proceedings. He says she did come on to him once, but as a married man, he told her that wasn't going to happen again.
Wow. So a lot going on both sides of the race for the 7th District there in California. How tight is the race?
Well, neither side is willing to release their numbers. The race in the primary, Bera won by a healthy margin. It wasn't outstanding, certainly, but I think it was in the 6-7% range. But that was in the primary, and neither one of them really did much in the way of campaigning. In previous years, the race has been pretty tight. Bera lost his first attempt back in 2010, but then won in 2012, and then won again against former Congressman Doug Osee in one of the most expensive races in recent memory or of all time back in 2014.
And Bob, what are the major issues in this race?
Well, we talked to both candidates in the last couple of days, and one of the complaints against Ami Bera lodged by some of the people in the music and film industry is his, what they're calling his support of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a trade deal. And so he was sort of explaining what his support actually qualified.
I was one who supported President Obama's ability to negotiate the deal. We're in the process of meeting with all the stakeholders, labor, the business community, the environmental community, and evaluating the trade deal.
And how have the people who were critical of Representative Bera responding to that?
Well, they are on a West Coast tour right now, flying a blimp over the offices of congressmen and women who voted similarly to allow the president to go forth with these negotiations. Sheriff Scott Jones came out against the trade deal rather a long time ago, saying that there wasn't enough validation to make sure that it wasn't going to do more harm than good. Says he generally supports trade deals, but in this case, he doesn't feel this one does enough to protect business in the United States.
Hmm. And Bob, of course, this race is happening in the context of the presidential election as well. How is the race for the White House affecting the candidates there in California?
Well, Ami Bera is trying to make some hay out of the recent drop in poll numbers for Donald Trump. Scott Jones has come out in favor of Trump's candidacy, perhaps as much as coming out against Hillary Clinton's candidacy as he is really coming out for Trump. And really, he says the race for Congress really probably shouldn't be judged on how either one of them is going to vote for president.
My issues are out there and well-established. So to unfairly paint either Congressman Bera for supporting Hillary or me for my willingness to vote for Donald Trump, I think is a little bit unfair, and I think a little bit beyond what the voters for this congressional race actually care about.
That's Sheriff Scott Jones there. He's a Republican running for Congress in California's 7th District. And Bob Moffitt, Sacramento Region reporter at Capital Public Radio, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, some big news from outer space today. Scientists have announced the discovery of an Earth-like planet orbiting our solar system's nearest neighboring star, Proxima Centauri. Rumors of the discovery have circulated in the last couple weeks, but today the European Southern Observatory confirmed it as true. Kelly Beattie is senior editor at Sky and Telescope. He's with us via Skype. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Jeremy.
So when we say Earth-like planet, how Earth-like is it?
Better would be to say Earth mass. What we know about this planet is actually very little. We know its orbit. It goes around this star at a distance of about 4 million miles, which is really close. And it has a mass that's comparable to the Earth's. And that's really about all we know.
How did we just discover this?
Well, the team that discovered it used a technique called the Doppler wobble. So they're not actually detecting the planet, but they're detecting its effect on the star that it's going around, in this case, Proxima Centauri. And as the planet goes around once every 11.2 days, it creates a wobble that makes the star nudge a little bit toward and away from us here on Earth, and we can detect that wobble in the star. And so that's what told us that this planet exists, and it gave us a sense of how far away it is, how long it takes to go around, and how massive it is.
And tell us more about Proxima Centauri, this red dwarf star, the nearest to our sun, which this planet is orbiting.
Yeah, ordinarily, if I said that the planet was only 4 million miles away, you would think, well, it's fried, it's toast. But this is an M dwarf star. Astronomers know that this particular star has only about an eighth of the mass of our sun. It's half the temperature. And more importantly, it's got only 1/600th the brightness, 0.15%. So that means that from the planet's perspective, it's not nearly as hot as you might think. And it actually puts it in what's called the habitable zone, a temperature region near the star where water would be liquid, neither gas nor frozen. So it would be just right.
How many other planets at this point do we know about that orbit in that habitable zone?
Well, around this particular star, none. This is the first. We know of several dozen other planets that orbit in their habitable zones. Not all of them are the size of Earth. So this is where we're starting to home in on this notion of a planet that's truly Earth-like. What's important here is that this is a stable star. The planet is small enough that we could imagine it to be rocky, maybe with an atmosphere. And the temperature is, in the Goldilocks scheme, just right.
Kelly, I feel like this isn't the first time that you and I have had a conversation about something like this. Maybe it's not as Earth-like as this planet, but it's an Earth-like planet somewhere out there. Are people like you and people like our listeners probably excited about this more because it's a future home for humans when we destroy Earth, as we might do, or because we may find alien life and we may actually be close to finding that?
Yeah, so this star is 4.25 light years away. That means that the light we're receiving now left in, May of 2012, if I've got the math right. You know, the important thing here is that there are far more of these M dwarfs in our galaxy and in the universe in general than what we think of as, you know, really bright or massive stars. So that means that the potential for lots and lots of these planets that we could imagine calling home must exist. And in fact, this discovery today opens the door for finding other planets around M dwarf stars in abundance in the future years ahead.
And if somebody out there has a really powerful telescope, can they see this planet from Earth, or is that not possible?
Yeah, not the planet. You can see the star. The star is what we call 11th magnitude, which means it's several hundred times fainter than you can see by eye, but the telescope could definitely pick it up. The problem is that you'd need to go to the southern hemisphere because Centaurus, this constellation, Proxima Centauri, is really only visible and seen best from like Australia or Chile.
Haven't you told us before that the southern hemisphere always gets the better night sky?
Boy, you know, if I could retire someplace, it would probably be in the southern hemisphere because the skies there are just awesome.
That's Kelly Beede, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Kelly, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy.
We're going to hear a conversation with the man who was called the moral architect of the Iraq War. He is Kanaan Makiya, currently a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University. Back in 2002 and 2003, Makiya was an unofficial spokesman for the Iraqi community in exile. He met with members of the Pentagon, State Department, and President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney in the run-up to the war. He also contributed governance plans to the State Department's 2003 Future of Iraq project. Makiya's books, Republic of Fear and Cruelty and Silence, deeply influenced administration officials and policy advisors pushing for a U.S. invasion of Iraq. Well, Iraq today is, of course, in chaos. And after the 2003 invasion, Makiya didn't put pen to paper as he, in the words of the New York Times, struggled to make sense of his own role in the catastrophe. Well, this spring, he finally published his latest book, a novel. It's called The Rope. We talked about it when Kanaan Makiya recently visited our studios. I mean, let me start with a little bit more about what the New York Times wrote about in a review of your book, that it represents a decade of introspection for a man whose life's work was closely associated with a costly war. And then they say, the book is also an apology for bestowing legitimacy on a group of men incapable of ruling Iraq. Is that what it is? Is it an apology?
It is an apology not for the war. It is an apology for having played a role in conferring some kind of legitimacy upon what was called in the old days the Iraqi opposition, and most of whose members today occupy major seats of power, and they were empowered and put in place by the American war. So in that sense, I deeply regret that. I apologize for it specifically and explicitly, especially in the Arabic edition, where I have a much longer apology.
So who specifically are you apologizing to?
People of Iraq, the Shiite community into which I was born, and all those Iraqis who used to follow my writings and my various and sundry appearances over the years. And that's important because I am not saying, if I may be absolutely clear, that I would do anything other than support a war to overthrow that particular dictatorship, namely the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. To be honest with you, Magna, I wouldn't know how to do anything else. The be-all and end-all of my life was certainly not to promote a war, but it was to write about dictatorship. And I became so convinced of the criminality of that particular regime, I was utterly convinced, and still am today, that its removal by any means necessary, I might add, was a moral thing to do. Think of a Syrian person today whose family are sitting in Aleppo with barrel bombs being dropped on their heads by the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and you will understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, but I mean, speaking of Syria, though, I mean, many analysts would say that the quagmire of Syria is directly related to the catastrophe in Iraq.
I don't agree. The state of Arab affairs, if I might say so, the very fact that Syria fell apart, that Libya is falling apart, that Yemen, one country after another, is falling apart, indicates that what went wrong is not the caused by the 2003
war. Well, let me clarify then. The international community's either response or lack of response, depending on your point of view. That's what people point to Iraq as being a major influencing factor.
I realize that, but I think that's an immoral and indefensible position when hundreds of thousands of people are being killed in a matter of a very short period of time. So the question is what it is that one is pushing for. The issue of Syria is not just ISIS. The problem is what will replace ISIS. And here we get to the real roots of what went wrong in Iraq. Mm-hmm. That is the failure of the Arab state system, if I might put it that way. We're witnessing a failure that's decades in the making, not just the 12 or 13 years since 2003.
The book has been reviewed, and you yourself say that your novel is an indictment of the Iraqi ruling elite and its failures after the 2003 war invasion. But I have to ask you, there was ample evidence before the U.S. invasion that such an outcome might come to pass. I mean, I was looking at a 2002 Boston Globe article where you yourself said that you think there's less than a 5% chance that what I'd like to see happens actually happens. But it seems to be an obligation, the invasion, even if it's only a 5% chance to make it happen. And then, I was looking at, for example, George Packer, writer for The New Yorker, who you know very well, who in 2003, just 17 days before the invasion began, said that the closer we get to war, the harder it is to believe that the liberal democracy Kanan Makiya envisions will ever be the outcome. People had misgivings about the capacity of the ruling elite to govern before we even began shock and awe.
They had doubts about its ability to deliver a democracy.
But that was what was being sold to the American people to justify the war.
That's what George Bush sold the American public to, weapons of mass destruction, actually was the main sort of bill of sale. I never bought into that. I never thought weapons of mass destruction, whether he had them or not, was the main issue. The issue for me, the be-all and end-all of my life has been the issue of dictatorship. That dictatorship, and this is an extreme form of dictatorship. It's probably the Arab world's most extreme dictator. That for me was non-negotiable. The dictator had to go. Now, I thought there was a slim chance, and I thought it was the obligation of people like me to make that transition into the 5%, 10% that you mentioned, towards democracy.
So let me ask you, because studying why the aftermath happened and in the way that it did is of profound interest. Because, you know, it was what, your 1993 book, Cruelty and Silence? You were already expressing very reasoned and passionate doubts about the Arab intelligentsia.
True.
But it was a faction of that same intelligentsia that was told to go and take Iraq into an Arab democracy.
But I felt, and I still think it's true, as an activist. Now, I wear two hats. On the one hand, the professional hat. I'm a writer. I do my best to tell the things as I see them. On the other hand, I was an activist for the removal of that particular dictator, Saddam Hussein. And in my activist hat, I know the world and options are full of choices. People, men, and they were, alas, mostly men who came to power in the post-2003, make choices. And they need not have made those choices. They could have made other choices. Now, you may say there's a slim chance that they would make the right choices, as I did, and as you quoted me. But it's still my obligation, I think it's even a moral obligation, to press for the successful coming to being of those choices, however slim the chance may be. Think of the American Revolution. What were the chances of defeating the British and establishing the kind of constitution, the kind of republic that the United States became? Slim. But men took the chance. They opted, so to speak, on the basis of what was the least likely thing to happen. And I think that was the right thing to
do. More than 4,500 Americans have died. More than 165,000 Iraqis have been killed since 2003. I mean,
I'm not.
What does the 5% chance mean to the survivors of those killed?
The 5% is what I would work towards, and my chances of it's not the reason for going to war. The overthrow of the dictator, the beginning of a new life. Remember what Iraq was like on the eve of 2003. No hope for the future existed. So the beginning of hope, I gambled on hope. I mean, think of the title of President Obama's book.
The Audacity of Hope.
That's exactly. I dared to bet on hope, and I would do it again.
You know, in the book, I get the sense that, you know, you question yourself about where you went wrong in your thinking. I wonder if writing this novel, is it Kanan Mikia sort of grappling with – it sounds like maybe not, because you just said that you still dare to hope, but it does that genuinely continue to be true?
I have demons inside me like everybody else, I'm sure, and perhaps I am doing that.
Kanan Mikia, there's one last thing I want to ask you. I mean, the reason why you wrote this book and the things you're thinking matters because you did have a front row seat to the decision-making process in the run-up to the Iraq War. You know, you did have connections with the people making the decisions about what would happen after. And so it just got me thinking, Dexter Filkins in 2007 of the New York Times, he wrote this about you. He says, "It seems Mikia's heart, his passion to destroy Hussein, his passion to bring freedom to Iraq, does not want him to go where his intellect would take him." And he describes you as a man of very high intellect. He says, "Where would it go? What would it say? Possibly something like this. You exposed a terrible dictatorship, and for the noblest of motives, you signed on to an invasion that ended in catastrophe. You misjudged your native country and your adopted one, too." Is that what your novel is saying?
I didn't misjudge large numbers of people. I misjudged the leaders who came to power in the immediate post-2003 time. I knew those men. I worked with those men. But in the end of the day, I was not a member of any particular party or organization. I was a writer. And while people may have listened or may have read my pieces, nobody went to war. The United States certainly did not go to war because Kanan Mikia asked it to. So, I mean, one should be, you know, humble as to one's ability to influence such things. The United States is a great big power. It does what it does for its own reasons. I made my voice clear. Dictatorship, the be-all and end-all of my life, the struggle against dictatorship, that was for me important, still is important, not just in Iraq but in Syria, and I still stand by that.
Well, Kanan Mikia, his new book, a novel, is The Rope. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Meghna.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
As of today, Tim Cook has been at the helm of Apple for 5 years after taking over from the visionary Apple founder Steve Jobs. The company continues to be very profitable, although this year there was a drop in sales for the first time in a decade. For a look at Apple under Tim Cook and what the next 5 years might bring for the company, we're joined by Maggie Lake, who's host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She's with us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy. Good to be here.
Well, as you look back on Tim Cook's tenure at Apple so far, what are some of the biggest successes?
Maybe that he survived. I mean, stepping into those shoes had to be one of the hardest, I think, transitions any CEO has faced, honestly. And he has stood up to it. If you're an investor, you certainly like the performance. Financials have to be right up there as part of the success. Their revenue and stock price has both doubled. Now, yes, it happened in a bull market, and you could argue that's because of the groundwork that Steve Jobs laid out. But Tim Cook has sort of taken that ball and continued to run with it and nurture the success. And I think even his critics would say, listen to customers. You know, they came out with the big phone, the Plus, which Steve Jobs had resisted for a long time. That was a great success. So he has sort of continued on, if you want to put it that way. And I think the other people credit Cook with, the thing they credit him with, is maybe being a little bit more willing to take a position. We sort of know where Apple stands a little bit more. They took that hard stance with the government when it came to accessing user information in San Bernardino. He's been public about, you know, gay rights. So maybe a little bit more open than the famously secretive Steve Jobs.
Well, and I remember speaking to somebody before Tim Cook took over, who said, you know, he doesn't see around corners the way that Steve Jobs does. He's a guy that really makes the trains run on time. But is it fair to say that innovation has slowed at Apple, or is that not fair?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, listen, could anybody be another Steve Jobs? I think we all agree that that was sort of a once-in-a-lifetime, certainly visionary when it came to the company. But no company's one person, and a lot of people would argue there are still a lot of innovative people at Apple. I think what's happening is that there's a transition in general in the world of tech where we're moving away from hardware, and that being what it's all about, into a time when it's going to end up being about services, about data, about artificial intelligence. And I think everyone's sort of rushing, putting a lot of money into research and development, and we're just beginning to see what that's going to look like. And I'm not sure that we can rule Apple out. Are they the clear leaders? No, they're not. It's kind of an open field, and there's a lot of competition. But I think that this time of Apple is coinciding with the time of change for technology. So I think the jury's still out when it comes to innovation there.
But even as Apple has all this competition, it also has traditionally been ahead of the curve in putting out products that everybody has to copy.
Yeah.
In this case, we're waiting for the iPhone 7 in September, right? Is that likely to be a big hit, or do we know at this point?
I don't know if we're going to continue to get excited about the actual hardware. I mean, listen, maybe we are. They're talking about having no jack for the headphones. I mean, to me, this is sort of, you know, I'm gonna use it when it can no longer work with every. That's when I'm gonna replace mine. And if I have to buy more stuff like pricey wireless earbuds, I'm not gonna be happy about that. The camera improving, yes, I think the next big hit is gonna be when somebody has a service that you just can't live without. There have been little hints of this. You know, there was a lot of critics really like Apple Pay, but it hasn't been widely adopted yet. But no digital wallet has. You know, we're not quite there where everybody feels they have to have something in someone's ecosystem. That's what we're waiting for now, I think.
Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
It's time now for an opera edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Joining us now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Ryan Lohr of Minnesota Public Radio. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I always love doing these opera DJ sessions, not least because the music is fantastic, but also because it's so hard to say the names of most of it or the people that are playing it. So correct me if I'm wrong here as we go along, but let's start with this piece from Beethoven. This is conducted by Leonard Bernstein with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. This is Mir ist so wunderbar from Fidelio. Tell us about this piece.
So I picked this because one of the things I love about my job is I'm constantly getting to discover new things, even if they're really old. And Gundula Janowitz is a soprano who I came to discover about 4 years ago. And once I discovered her, I just kind of started listening to everything that she had recorded. And this recording really popped out to me. There's so much about Beethoven that is really hard, whether you're singing or an instrumentalist. And I think it's really exploited here in this quartet, also known as the Canon Quartet. You know the song Row, Row, Row Your Boat?
Yeah.
It's a canon, so the text is different, but the melody is exactly the same. But what makes Beethoven so hard is the way he will like stack the voices on top of each other and the distance between them. That's something that really has a unique Beethoven sound. And then articulation, so the length of notes. And when you listen from the very beginning of this piece all the way to the end, the people match each other so perfectly, and they've picked just the right length that for me really makes this come to life as a true piece of Beethoven's music.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of it. All right, well, on to the next one that you brought us. This is Tristan and Isolde, Liebestod, or Love Death, by Richard Wagner, with soprano Birgit Nilsson and the orchestra of the Bayreuth Festival and conductor Carl Bohm. This is from 1966. Such drama in her voice there.
There is. She's known as a dramatic soprano.
And what should we know about this one?
So, Birgit Nilsson is one of my all-time favorite singers, and it is mostly because she can do something that no one else can do. And as you just heard, she is singing with this amazing sound over a huge orchestra. You know, Wagner was really known for expanding the size of the orchestra in the pit and getting these really big, loud, lush sounds out of the orchestra, and she has one of the few voices ever that has really just been able to carry over the orchestra without any kind of force. And once Nilsson was asked, you know, how do you do this? Because, I mean, this is a marathon role.
Yeah.
And she said, a lot of practice and a really comfortable pair of shoes.
A really comfortable pair of shoes. Interesting. I would have thought, like, a ton of water or something like that.
She was also known for, like, having a huge steak before she sang.
Wow, that's interesting. I feel like you shouldn't even eat, or, you know, they've often said in the radio business, like, don't drink coffee before you go on the air because it'll tighten up your vocal cords.
Yeah, I have a piece of candy sitting on my desk for right after this.
All right. Well, let's get to another one that you brought us, and this is by Richard Strauss. This is Renee Fleming, who we've had on the show before, actually, very famous opera singer, and Kathleen Battle. They are singing soprano with Frederica von Stade as mezzo-soprano with the Berlin Philharmonic, and Claudio Abbado conducting. This is the final trio from Der Rosenkavalier. Now, you say there's something interesting we should know about the female singers here.
Yeah, so Strauss loved two things. He loved the French horn, because his dad was a French horn player, and he loved the female voice. A lot of the female roles he conceived of were for he had his wife in mind.
Hmm.
And so what's interesting about this is you have two women and a male, but because he loves the female voice so much, the male Octavian is actually played by a mezzo-soprano.
So the poor male opera singer that lived in that town.
Yeah, but lucky for us, we get this amazing trio. And it is my opinion that this is the best recording of the final trio.
Well, Ryan, we have time for one more that you wanted us to hear. This is from earlier this year, actually, this performance from the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra featuring soprano Anita Hartig. This piece is by Giacomo Puccini. It is Turandot, Signore Ascolta. About Anita Hartig, because a lot of people may not have heard of her.
I had not heard of her until I saw the Met broadcast in January.
Hmm.
She's a Romanian lyric soprano. She sang La Boheme at the Met. She sang a role in The Magic Flute this past year also. I rarely leave an opera these days and feel like I need to text somebody like, oh my gosh, have you heard of this person? And as soon as I left, I had two friends who I'm always talking opera with, who I immediately was like, you need to go hear this person. Have you heard of this person? Mm. She was amazing. There's both like a warmth and delicacy and clarity to her voice all at the same time, which I was really drawn to that I don't hear often.
Now, not everyone in this country and not everyone who's listening has access to good opera where they live. Do you have a lot of it there in the Twin Cities?
The Minnesota Opera is an amazing opera company. They do four shows a year. Last season, they did the world premiere of Paul Morvec's The Shining, and it was absolutely spectacular.
That's Minnesota Public Radio's Ryan Lohr bringing us some of his opera favorites today on the DJ Sessions. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tanks and troops rumbled across the main square in Kiev today as Ukraine marked 25 years of independence following the collapse of the Soviet Union. The show of force was clearly aimed at Russia, which has been engaged in a prolonged conflict with Ukraine for more than 2 years. The BBC's Tom Burridge joins us from Kiev. And Tom, tell us more about how Ukraine is marking this anniversary.
Yeah, well, there was a huge military parade in Kiev this morning. Tanks, armored personnel carriers, artillery, surface-to-air missiles, troops marching along, all sort of rolling through Independence Square. So that's the place, of course, in 2014 where protesters essentially forced the pro-Russian president back then, Yanukovych, from power. So a poignant place. And of course, you know, Independence Day, yes, it's 25 years on since independence from the Soviet Union for Ukraine. But, you know, Ukraine has a battle over its sovereignty today with the war in the east of the country and, of course, Russia's annexation of Crimea. So, you know, the word independence has added meaning, I think, in this country.
So given that, what did President Poroshenko say when he spoke today?
He quite predictably talked about the Donbass, so that's the east of Ukraine. Remember that rebel groups, separatist groups there backed by Russia still hold very small parts of land, but two provinces right out in the east. And of course, Russia annexed Crimea. So he has predictably spoken about Crimea, about the east of Ukraine, and about, you know, his desire to one day, you know, raise the Ukrainian flag over those territories again. In reality, there's no sort of sign of that happening anytime soon. But, you know, today, I think, was about sending a sort of signal to Moscow. There was a lot of history about, you know, Ukrainian independence, not only from the Soviet Union, the struggle to leave the Soviet Union and resistance towards the Soviet Union and other empires before that, but also really, you know, Ukraine's struggle today. It's sort of quest for true independence. You know, it is an independent country, but of course, you know, its much more powerful neighbor has been sort of flexing its military might in recent years, of course, and really kind of threatening sort of Ukrainian sovereignty, you know, not only in the east, but also in Crimea. And to be honest, you know, the sort of mindset here in Ukraine, a sort of a very kind of commonplace theory is that, you know, Russia's strategy essentially is to sort of undermine the bid to get Ukraine functioning, to get it becoming a sort of a more positive, a more successful democratic nation, both in political and economic terms.
Well, let's talk about what's happening specifically in the East with a little more detail. I mean, thousands dead, 2 million people displaced. How involved is Moscow in what's going on in eastern Ukraine?
Yeah, well, yeah, 9,500 people have died since the conflict began 2 and a bit years ago. Your question is very hard to answer, to be honest. I think what we can say with certainty is that Russia has been involved. Russia continues to deny it, but I think, you know, at some point you just have to look at the evidence on the table. Ukraine has taken Russian soldiers prisoner. There's been some very, very credible evidence on Russian social media of soldiers essentially posting selfies in basically the sort of the eastern territory controlled by the separatists. So a sort of common theory amongst a lot of analysts, people who know Ukraine well, is that the Russians have been involved very much in terms of the strategy, in terms of directing operations in the east of Ukraine. They probably haven't had as many boots on the ground as the Ukrainians sometimes claim. But when there has been a key kind of uptick in the violence, sort of the summer of 2014, if you go to the winter of 2014 into 2015, when the separatists made significant gains, I think it's pretty clear and the evidence is there that the Russians did get involved in a much more serious way and, you know, unsurprisingly, had quite a dramatic impact on the ground in favor of the separatists.
Well, finally, Tom, I mean, we're talking about this today because Ukraine is celebrating the 25th anniversary of its independence from the Soviet Union. But as we've been discussing, there's this protracted conflict between Ukraine and Russia. So how is the rest of Europe looking upon this day?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And towards the end of this year, that question is going to come into sort of sharp focus because sanctions against Russia by the European Union will be up for renewal. Now, there are sanctions for Russia's annexation of Crimea. Those sanctions look to remain. But the sanctions related to the war in the east of Ukraine, by all accounts, are probably going to be watered down that because some southern European nations, namely Italy, Greece, maybe even France, even though France has played a big sort of role in terms of brokering the failed peace agreement, and some countries like Hungary, they're in favor basically of kind of giving Russia a bit of a break. You know, Italy, for example, has strong financial economic ties with Russia. Countries like Britain and Germany and Eastern European countries like Poland are very resolute. They want to keep a very, very tough line against Russia for its actions in relation to Ukraine. But there is division. And I think, you know, a source close to the president here in Ukraine told me a few weeks ago that the expectation is that some of those sanctions linked to the war in the east of the Ukraine will actually be watered down towards the end of the year.
Well, the BBC's Tom Burridge speaking with us from Kiev. Tom, thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.